Hey humans, welcome back to another episode of Cast from the Creek, Stories of Nature and Community. My name is Matt Ruhlinger, and this week we have a repeat from our last season in Doug Wenzel. He's going to be talking to us about some of the patterns and things that we can be looking for as the seasons begin to change. As I'm recording this now, a lot of leaves are sitting in my yard, and the weather is about to take a turn for the briskier. So please enjoy the conversation that Doug and I have and the knowledge that he shares with us. So without further ado, let's get to this week's episode. Because I'm not 100% cognizant of, since it's been so dry, are we just more likely to see just the leaves fall instead of really, like, or the change in color be so rapid that we really don't get to enjoy the ridges changing and things like that? I mean, I'm just curious if that's in your experience.
Sure,
what are things that you'll see?
Yeah, so it has been dry, and I don't know the latest drought status, but certainly Huntington itself, the city, is under water restriction. Everyone here should certainly be aware of conserving water. It's been certainly dry, and that does translate to trees under stress. And so trees under stress, deciduous trees, are going to cut their losses a little bit sooner. So I think the fall foliage will just be shortened. They'll still be pulling energy out of the leaves. Chlorophyll breaks down, so you still see colors, but it'll just be quicker and certainly not as dramatic. And the first good rainstorm in, you know, mid-October might take a lot of leaves down. So, which is it's unfortunate, but that's just part of every year is a little bit differently. Don't know if the first frost will be delayed. You know, with climate change and how that it certainly you can't predict. I mean, frost appear even warm springs, you know, you can have a late frost, a clear night, so that'll be of interest to see. Will it be a typical, you know, October frost? Will it be a little bit later? We're sitting outside, so this background noise, I'd be able to pick up blue jay and crow, but also the tree crickets. So once the frost hits, everything really goes quiet, so it'll just be of interest to see when the frost hits this year, real killing frost, and how long will we be able to take in just the sounds of insects. And one of the, for me, a key to the season is moving on, we're really into fall, is the daytime singing of katydids. So right now I have not heard that, but when you start hearing katydids singing,
how you know.
Well, it's just they're getting desperate for they're getting desperate for a mate, and so why wait till night? I can sing during the day too. Become a little more foolhardy. I don't know.
Gotcha.
Fall migration's been going on. We're third week September. A lot of broadwing hawks have already passed. Monarchs are still moving through. So it's been. There's certainly a transition there. Other things I look at for us is just the continued dying and death of white ash and black ash that we have around the center. So that's been a change. And, there's winners and losers. It'll be interesting to look at records of woodpecker sightings and see if, just having more places to forage, the dead ash, although we'll cut the ones right around the center, will having standing dead ash, they seem to not, it'd be interesting to see how long the trees will stand. They're not nearly as hardy as elms and other trees that have died recently. They seem to stand for a number of years, 10 years or more when we top them. White pine also seems to stand in place after they're topped. But right around the picnic, the outdoor classroom here, there's some ash that are topped 20, 25 feet off the ground. How long are they going to be standing? So there's just been a lot of dead ash. Woodpeckers might respond by more woodpeckers foraging in the dead ash, looking for those emerald ash borer larval forms. Dead trees create more potential for cavity nesters. So we'll see how that runs its course.
How do you bring this to most people's attention? I guess because so your interpretation class is happening right now,
yeah.
Right? So what is that process like, getting them to be more observant? Do you find that, because I mean, you just listed off a whole bunch of things that just being observant and noticing and
sure.
kind of talking the story behind that, like, what is that journey like for your students coming into that class?
Well, we do a phenology moment, so it's a park interpretation or an environmental interpretation class. So trying to, it's like a speech class, but it's grounded in the outdoors, you know, being a curious naturalist, trying to intersect with the natural world. And so that provides the content. And so by doing just a quick minute and a half, each student at the beginning of a class time, so we take turns, but just saying, hey, monarch migration is beginning. You should look out. So that's in late August we were talking about maybe monarchs. So it gives them a chance to get up in front of their peers, in front of the class, and share a piece of information that we all can observe. So sometimes, you know, I may role model what might be a good phenology moment, at least in my curious mind. And then hopefully they will take that and share pieces of the natural world with their class. So it does two things. And so using phenology moments to tie in things like bird migration or being out in the field and seeing these dead and dying ash trees. So we were at the Arboretum. I think we were talking more about oaks at that point, but at any time we're out and about just trying to look for these intersections of class time with what's happening in the natural world, certainly with bird walks. So we've been doing migration morning in the month of September, and you can't, every Wednesday we've come across woodpeckers on ash trees, so
wow.
It's very easy to make that connection there.
Hmm. So what are some of the most common patterns I think people are noticing are migration of large animals, so birds, monarchs, I guess changing in the green space around them. What are some of the more subtle things that I think people could I think take for granted that they notice and how
sure.
things are changing?
I really like this late summer fall insect noise that we mentioned earlier. These tree crickets are here, and it's part of our, if you're out in the any sort of small woodlot, backyard habitat, you hear especially in the evening, but in this daytime chorus as well. It's just very subtle, but if you listen, you hear it. At night, the katydids, there's cone-headed grasshoppers. So just the soundscape that will all come crashing to a halt first frost. And if you're not paying attention, if you're not cognizant of the sound, then maybe you don't realize that you miss it, or just like, wow, now fall sounds very
strangely quiet. Yeah.
Again, with the bird walks, just talking about the lack of song that we're hearing in the morning. You know, even first light, birds really are quiet at, you know, sun up. If it was May, June, into July, you know, you get this real chorus of bird song, but bird song is really, for the most part, absent in the fall. So if you don't pay attention to the fact that robins were singing in my backyard, you weren't aware of it months ago, maybe you're not aware of the fact that, oh, robins are not singing anymore in my backyard. This time of year, being out at night again, just the gray horned owls start calling, you know, their sound will pick up in October and November. Other owls will also begin to be hooting or calling or trilling, lots of different calls there. So, yeah, you can pick those sounds up. I think that's fun. Just noticing which trees are turning now, I think, is subtle. So you see not only trees, but woody vines like poison ivy, grapevine. There's that connection of foliar fruit flagging. I'm looking right now across there, that Virginia creeper that's going up that white pine, those leaves are turning red, the signal that the berries are ripening. So they have dark blue berries, which don't maybe pop very much to our eyes. Maybe birds pay a little more attention, but it's thought that the red of those leaves makes it a little more noticeable for migrating birds. Gotcha. Sometimes those berries stay around into later fall, so it just right now is a great time to get them if you're a migrating bird.
Is it kind of bittersweet for birders this time of year? Because I'm so new to the birding game. Seems kind of like the end of a really active season, or just like an active period in life, and then so to have something that I know for you is a big passion, or just like a big part of your life, to be phasing out. Is it strange? How do you get your birding fix in the the off season?
Well, yeah, you know, when I first started, I was just May was the month to be out. You know, you had to be out in May, and that was wildflowers too. But September is very similar to May in a sense of abundance of things to look at as a naturalist. So what was underappreciated when I first started was just how magnificent fall bird watching is late summer. So the month of September is terrific, because the trade-off is it's quieter, so you're not able to find birds by, you know, listening to song. But for a beginning birder, that's okay. Because sometimes it's frustrating when you're trying to learn songs, and it can be a little overwhelming, the soundscape. So if you put that aside, the trade-off, though, is there's more birds. If, you know, everyone had a successful nesting season, certainly we're much more awash in birds in September than we were in May. So all those birds that journeyed north from the tropics are now heading back, and many of the adults are ahead of the young. So what we see in September in Pennsylvania, we still see adult warblers migrating through, and thrushes and tanagers, but you also see a lot of immatures. And so there's more birds. The ID can be a little tricky because immatures aren't brightly colored like some of the males. Sure. There's always exceptions there. But so the trade-off is they're quieter, but there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of movement. The leaves are falling now, so finding watching for movement can be a little tricky, because you have these leaves falling through the canopy, but that's just part of the game. So more birds than ever, and so I've appreciated September much more than I did when I started out. And as long as I take to the field realizing that in spring you have a higher chance of finding birds because of the song, and identifying because of their bright colors, fall you just sort of have to go under the assumption of I may not be able to figure out everything that I see, but it'll be fun. And for more experienced birders, especially as you get older, we start to lose our hearing anyway. So
you're prepared.
I'm sort of getting ready for the next stage of life, you know, this transition into beginning to lose, you know, you lose your hearing as you age. I think it starts relatively early. We just don't realize it. Certainly birds that sing, you can pick up still many of those songs. Mm-hmm. And I haven't lost, you know, knock on wood, I haven't lost too much of my higher range. But, yeah, it's quieter pastime in fall birding, but lots of birds.
So what are you getting ready for, I think, in terms of with the center changing, how does that going to affect the things that you'll be experiencing going through? I know we kind of talked about in the beginning before recording on the interns and taking care of that, but also the seed semester. How is that going to look and feel with kind of the center being under what it is? So,
yeah, it's...
I don't know, that was a very direct question.
I think for all of us here, it's wrapping our mind around what does that look like being closed and being under renovation. So we're certainly familiar with the downtime in December and January. So we've done that. So we know what that feels like. We know that people are still walking around, you know, hikers are moving through. People still come to visit the birds. And so we still see a number of visitors walking around, but we're not going to see as many. And then once construction begins, you know, we have the septic, hopefully this fall soon. So those are going out to bid or have gone out to bid. Construction will start for real in March, at least that's the hope. And I don't know what it's going to feel like. Is it going to be a lot of, you know, digging noise? Am I going to want to be here as a staff member? Am I going to work off-site more? I don't know what that's going to look like. But for students, certainly January, February, I think will feel pretty normal this year anyway. Getting into March when construction begins, we certainly won't be here as much, but at least to start, it'll feel the same. What we'll be missing for our intern staff is just the on-site school programs this fall, No Children's Halloween Trail, which is kind of certainly sad, because Children's Halloween Trail has been, you know, that's 25 years or more, probably 30 years of that program. So that's a real trick-or-treat. That's certainly a trick this year. So we'll miss Children's Halloween Trail, but I'm optimistic that our membership will be patient with us, that the people who've come to Halloween Trail, I apologize to small children everywhere for not hosting it. It's just, with getting ready for the renovation and packing things away and moving things, it would have taken a lot of effort to put it on, and just the uncertainty and not knowing and trying to get the septic done. So I think it's better for the program in the long run to take a year off and make sure, because we've gotten used to trying to produce a quality program, and I'm not sure we would have been able to do that. It would have been a difficult thing to assure the quality, because not knowing what was happening at the site. So interns will miss that, staff will miss that, community will miss that, but I know it'll come back even better. We're dedicated to doing that. So, apologize for four-year-olds. Come back when you're five. We'll do our best to make
it. We have a pretty large four-year-old audience on this show.
Yep. So, interns not having on-site school visits, we miss that. But I think it provides an opportunity to do some things professional development-wise, allow interns to do maybe some more career shadowing. Intern staff just went to Hawk Mountain yesterday, which is something they probably would have been much more difficult to do with school programs here. So I think the internship it'll be different. I don't think it will be worse for the wear of not having some of those programs. It'll just be different.
More traveling naturalist programs.
Yeah, more ability to take the program on the road. Outdoor school will be very robust this fall with 7 weeks, so they'll get a lot of teaching experience with school groups, which is exciting. And it also gives us a chance to step back from school, on-site visits, and work with area school districts and really kind of reimagine what it could be. How do we fit it together better, be more intentional in what we're doing with the school groups?
So what does that look like? I guess, what is your perception on, like, taking this breath for a year, and then where are areas that you think you'll pour that time into focusing more on or taking a second look at?
For me, teaching the environmental interp course, not having Children's Halloween Trail, which has been part of that course for 25 years, before Children's Halloween Trail, Haunted Trail was part of 325. So to take the celebration of this cultural event, Halloween, and take it off the table as content to interpret for the Children's Trail, kind of morphing that into a celebration of biodiversity. So that'll come back. But by taking it out of the content of this environmental interp class has allowed me to just think creatively about, okay, so we're not going to interpret that. What can we interpret? So the assignment there is going to be looking at Penn State campus and all the features at main campus, and just allowing students to sort of interpret some of the things there. So it could be everything from the legend of the Nittany Lion, and that may get into, lions have been extirpated, mountain lions have been extirpated from Pennsylvania, driven to extinction. So those type of topics that I wouldn't have thought of before. And so it's always good to step back and be creative and think, I don't need to do that. What else can I do? So it's been an enjoyable process for me to think of how to continue to push my creative energies and still not lose sight of what we're trying to do with applying in-class work to out-of-class situations. So the trade-off is we're not doing anything with the general public, but we'll certainly work with peers. And then following into the seed semester, making sure that the assignments that we do feed into. So they'll be doing teamwork to create a field walk on campus for the seed semester. They'll continue to, individuals, develop their own 25-minute field walk. So I think it'll better fit into that. And I predict further down, this has given me some other thought about how to mesh the semesters together and sort of scaffold the experiences for our interpretive students. So I'm excited for what that might bring in the future. And I think students re-envisioning the Children's Halloween Trail class and allowing them a little more creative energy in that, taking that off the 325, the environmental interp class, and putting it more onto this Halloween class. So that's a direct tie to this break. For schools, again, just this breath of not having to do the on-site work with school groups, I think will be certainly nice for the program staff that focuses on schools, because now they have a chance to do the up work and look at the strategic, what really fits best for us as a center, for the school children, for the teachers. How do you balance all that out? And so that's a gift. We're really fortunate.
Can I ask for, how do you interpret Halloween and use that? So I've never experienced it. And I don't know, there may be people who, I know, I'm so new to this.
Oof, wow.
And who knows if they'll keep me around till next year. So just in case, I'm like,
sure.
How do you go about interpreting something that is, so it's commercialized in every other sense? I would never have thought until coming to Shavers Creek to think about Halloween. In terms of a natural expression or celebration,
Right. And so there's the cultural aspect of Halloween and how it was, how the Celts celebrated that. There's a religious undertone or overtone to Halloween. So trying to not so much focus on the cultural roots of Halloween, but look at the cultural, I would say maybe the, use the natural world as making it more obvious to people as a celebration of the season. And so using Halloween, inviting people to come out, because we want to celebrate these things. It's in our face, right? A meteor shower, if it's widely promoted and you have the right conditions to come out and, dark skies, and if the meteor shower only happens one night a year and you sort of feel compelled to celebrate the meteor shower and go out and stand in your backyard and look up, or go to a dark sky park like Cherry Springs and take in this made up, I'm just meteor shower
sure,
as an example. but it's that, oh, it's a full moon again this month. It's a blue moon, so I should go out and look, or an eclipse of something. People want to get out and celebrate this. Halloween is like that. So we want to buy a pumpkin because we're supposed to buy a pumpkin, but that's really, pumpkins locally are abundant this time of year for a reason, So there's this intersection of the bright colors of trees changing, deciduous trees. And so taking advantage of this idea that people want to celebrate Halloween, using that as a hook to get people to come out to celebrate Halloween with us, but taking that hook so you have this audience that's motivated to come out to Shavers Creek because it's Halloween, we need to celebrate.
Right.
And so dress up and pretend you're somebody else. But use the typical icons and just call more attention to the inspiration of those icons with the natural world. So that's whether it's spiders or owls or the black mask of a raccoon or camouflage or, leaf color, black and orange color. So just kind of use it to celebrate the natural world. And the way I've wrapped my mind around it is, you know, there's a lot of different pieces of the natural world. And so celebrating the diversity of life in our woods around Shavers Creek and use that as the backdrop to inspiring the six or seven stations that are developed. So it becomes, it's a celebration of Halloween, but it's a celebration of the natural world's inspiration behind why we celebrate Halloween.
How long did it take for you to develop, I guess, that? I mean, that's obviously, really complex, but also well thought out story of how all these things kind of come together.
I have to have a motivation for doing something. And so I had been tossing around for many years trying to wrap my own brain around why I'm doing Halloween Trail. So I am the reason behind killing the Haunted Trail. It was my instigation of, you know, bringing it up to other staff and trying to get there. It was an evening program. We were using students 3 nights, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It was 800 people a night. It was a huge impact on the trail system itself. And children were coming out, and we were scaring them in the woods, and we were scaring, you know, a lot of different people. And although there were stories there, I just thought that there was probably, at the same time, there was other haunted fire halls, haunted this, haunted that. And I was just thinking, you know, no one's going to necessarily miss a haunted. We're not the only group doing it.
Right.
And there are probably other, the blood and gore, the, just, it just, I just felt that, okay, we could have continued to do it, and that would have been, you know, we could have, but I just felt that there were other organizations that we weren't the only ones. And so, but what we could do well is, what if we focused on a children's event and for families? And that seemed to fit better with the clientele that we were serving. We could use Children's Halloween Trail, a daytime event. It wasn't quite so hard on the facility. And for the whole history of the Haunted Trail, for the 5 or 6 years that we did it, Children's Trail was running concurrently anyway as a matinee, and we weren't spending a lot of resources on Children's Halloween Trail. So my my sort of evolution of thought was, well, if we got rid of the Haunted Trail, the Children's Trail would be a better fit. And then it took me another 5, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever, to come to the idea of, we could really wrap it around biodiversity as a celebration of that and linking it, and that was even a better fit for me. And it seemed to be better to be able to tell the students why we're doing it as a celebration of biodiversity, not a celebration of black cats.
Scary children.
So,
thank you for taking the class.
Yes. So it was always a celebration, you know, for kids it was always magical. It was always meant to be a celebration of the natural world, but it was just nice to land on this idea of biodiversity. And a lot of different, you know, staff members over the years have certainly helped me with that thought and supported that idea and brought great ideas. And so, I don't know, making it a celebration of biodiversity, it was me that did it, but that was something that was informed by many people.
Sure, all the inputs. Is there, so the equinoxes are in spring and fall, correct?
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
the solstices are, so we passed the equinox
yes,
and we're working towards the solstice.
Yes.
So what is, I only got told yesterday that there's a tradition of solstice celebration here. And
oh,
we don't have to go into that, but I'm just curious. So what, I guess, what are some changes that we can look forward to noticing in our world between those two points? So is it vernal equinox in the fall, or is that the spring one?
So vernal is spring.
Vernal is spring.
And vernal is mean spring.
Okay.
So you could think of it autumnal equinox.
Okay.
Then another, yeah, because you'll remember autumn.
Right.
So now we are, we're now at equal daylight and night, and now we're heading towards the shortest day of the year,
mm-hmm,
with winter solstice. And then the clock, you know, then it falls back and we start gaining daylight again slowly in December 22nd or whatever the official Solstice Springs this, well, Springs, Solstice Falls on this December. It's usually right around the 21st, 22nd.
Gotcha.
So between now and then, you know, just again realizing that we're losing daylight at both ends. So sun comes up a little bit later, sun goes down a little bit earlier. And I think the quality, you know, the sun is lower in the sky. So the lighting, I think, you know, you do, if you pay attention to it, the lighting is different. The moon is now, you know, it is heavy. It's higher overhead mm-hmm. in the autumn into winter. So there's just little subtle things like that we notice. The quality of light. Certainly the, I think it's great. The lower humidity, stars are much more, you know, they seem brighter yeah. in the autumn air, drier air. Great to be out at night to see that. For bird watchers, with the drop of the deciduous leaves, it becomes easier to see birds. And there is an ebb and flow. Winter birds are coming this way. The winter finch forecast was just released yesterday.
Who does that?
There's a gentleman up in Canada that's writes it. His name escapes me, but I recognize his name as someone who's been doing it for years and years. And so what he pulls together data looking at the abundance of the cone crop, so the seeds in those cones of spruce and fir, mountain ash, alders, birch. So all these foods that finches, if they stayed further north, if there's an abundant cone crop, they would stay and eat those seeds in the winter. But if there's a failure of those cone crops for any particular tree, so you know there's natural cycles with those trees, because if they were every year to produce abundant seeds, then seed predators, birds that depend on seeds, and mammals would be able to adjust their numbers. Their numbers would continue to rise because this food source is always available, and there wouldn't be a lot of seeds to carry on for the next generation. So they get around that by producing bumper crops of seeds and then years of few seeds. So if you're a red squirrel and you're always depending on these seeds, there are years when they're just harder to find. And so for pine siskins, for redbreasts and nuthatches, for blue jays and chickadees that live in that boreal forest, those birds from time to time, because of seed shortages, will come south in abundance. So this forecast says, hey, it could be a good year for seeing pine siskins. They should erupt, not in huge numbers, but they will definitely erupt this year. Redbreasts and nuthatches are definitely coming south, and we've been seeing that already in August. We've been picking up redbreasts and nuthatches in my backyard. Local birders have been hearing them, seeing them in places higher than previous years. So they're definitely going to see more redbreasts and nuthatches. So it's fun to see that even though we think of, you know, birds leaving our state and going into the tropics or the Gulf region, which is true, we also benefit from those birds in the boreal regions and further north here of coming south and spending winter with us in tropical Pennsylvania, at least for them. So there's food here. And again, migration is driven by food, not so much temperature, although it does play a role in some migration. So it'll be fun to, you know, the season of bird feeding. White-throated sparrows and juncos, and what other birds will be new this winter based on just what's happening further north.
And do we have data? I mean, this sounds like a good example of citizen science. Sure. This gentleman just being observant, doing the legwork so the rest of us can know what's coming on down the pipeline. Do we have figures that we're seeing a steady trend in higher migration because of shortage of food up there? Because I'm just curious. So what is, like, is there a human in there's obviously some human influence,
sure,
onto what's going on,
yes,
that's compelling the food sources and then them to travel. But I'm just curious, is it steadily increasing? Do we not have that kind of information to make a judgment call on that? Or
so the natural cycles of seed abundance and years of scarcity, they happen. And whether or not they're people influenced in the forest, maybe to some extent of climate, but I don't I don't know if there's a clear tie between what goes on as far as seeds and climate as of yet. I don't think anyone's made that connection, although I'm sure it must be there in some way with rainfall, or you're able, or let's just put it this way, even if you wanted to produce a lot of seeds that year and you didn't have the resources to do it, that's going to affect it. So,
right.
So it's more from the citizen science perspective of being able to monitor and to see, in this case, there's a forecast saying this could be a good year for these particular species. These other species should stay north because there's abundant food say, Western Canada. They're moving across to take advantage of food abundance here. But what's nice is that through Project Feeder Watch and eBird, people are able to track the abundance and to see if the forecast is, you know, was it accurate? And how far did these birds show up? How far south did they go looking for seeds? Where did they wander to? So that ability to sort of to ground truth the forecast and just see where birds are spending their winter, Christmas bird count data will come into play. So it's just it's of interest to see what is really happening. And climate data and citizen science data is now being studied, and there is evidence to suggest that birds are coming, arriving earlier due to climate change and leaving a little later due to climate change, as it affects abundance of food sources locally. So there is a tie there, and citizen science data is helping us to understand that picture.
Is there a book or guide, or what are some things that for people who are kind of interested in becoming more observant of the changes that are happening around them this time of year or upcoming in the winter, or maybe just some books that you've been diving into recently that you think other people would be interested or should look into?
There is, so if you want to learn more about birds, I think that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology website, whether it's eBird or Project Feeder Watch or Yardbird, they offer ornithology courses for the layperson. Just a wealth of data that's readily available if you have internet connection and have a device that you can tap into that, or your local library.
Yeah.
That has just so many great resources. And then there is a Phenology Network also online, so if you just typed in Phenology, Phenology, not with an F, but that's the study of this phenomena that's layered against the calendar year. So, you know, when do flowers bloom? When do trees come into leaf? When do insects appear? That's phenology. When do birds migrate? When do they show up? So that's, again, readily available. You can be a volunteer and monitor phenology through the Phenology Network. As far as books, you know, I think fall is this season of reflection. So I think it, oftentimes, I like reading dead naturalist work and just kind of get a little reflection. So I've recently rediscovered Annie Dillard and Pilgrim at Tinker Creek as someone who is just in love with life. She is still alive, fortunately. She's not a dead naturalist. But I think of John Burroughs. He was a backyard naturalist upstate New York, and he was certainly this country's leading naturalist, you know, more than a century ago.
Wow.
So he's just someone who writes about his backyard. But there's so many good blogs of people who are observing their backyard. Of course, the Shaver's Creek Naturalist Notebook,
you know
the photo of the day, great places of information. But there certainly is a lot of people writing about the natural world, and including our LTERP authors. So great time to investigate that online bookshelf, as well as a trip to the library.
Mm-hmm.
So much to read.
Are there places that are kind of ritualistic for you to visit during this time of year to see and to check out?
Don't want to share
those because you don't want company.
I don't share those sites. I think you have to get to a hawk watch. There's really no reason not to, and even if you have mobility issues, you know, you can still Jack's Mountain, Tussie Mountain up at the Joe Hayes Vista, you can drive a car and really, even wheelchair wise, sit up there and take in the migration. So go to a hawk watch. Some of them are a little more rugged, some of them are Hawk Mountain in Kempton, PA, you know, 2.5 hours from here. It's just a great place and worth a pilgrimage too if you've never been to Hawk Mountain in September, October, and even early November is a beautiful place to go. And vistas everywhere to take in. You know, I'm sure we will get leaf color. We can see it already in some of these early black gum, which is now our witness tree. It's one of those ones that turn red relatively early, and they also have, you know, these blue fruits. That's another example of foliar fruit flagging. So to take in the leaf color and be a little curious as to, you know, you can certainly Google leaf color by species and find out, you know, maples turn yellow, then some reds, and oaks turn a different way, tulip tree, black gum. Mm-hmm. So there are colors you can associate. So vistas, great place to visit.
Do you make your way up to Benazet ever to check out the elk bugling, or is that a...
You know, interesting. I just saw this morning that Bald Eagle is hosting a visit to elk country. Bald Eagle State Park, Matt Truesdale. Shout out to Matt, former intern and student. Good guy. So Bald Eagle's hosting that. And I was thinking, you know, I really need to get up there. And why not this fall? So that's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's a personal place that I love to go. It's wild to be out there. So I guess the closing question that we've taken on this season has been kind of, it's stolen from Tim Ferriss, but adapted enough to, you know, that he can't come after. But the idea of, he asks, if you could put anything on a billboard, what would it be? And I take a more authoritarian approach, and then I ask people, if you could put a thought or a concept into people's minds, they just had an experience for that moment, what would that thought or concept be? So we've had people share about being present or things of that nature, and I'm just curious. So it can be about kind of transition or being observant, but what would you implant in people's minds, a thought or a concept?
I've been thinking a lot about campus, as you know, we're going to do these campus field walks. Joshua Potter and I are working with a class, Tom Hogan and Sustainable Communities. They're doing a class trying to encourage students to use the wonderful green spaces we have on campus. So we've been trying to create a campaign to get students outside into these green spaces for all the benefits that green spaces do, whether it's, you know, mental health, mental break, health, you know, just being outside is good for you. So that's as a subtext that's going in my brain, thinking about encouraging this. When I'm on campus, I have to drive there, park a car, and I try to park a little ways away so I can enjoy just, you know, a 5-10 minute walk through campus to get to the classroom. And I marvel at the difficulty in trying to make eye contact with students, with fellow community members on campus. I think I need to start gathering some data about how many people have their earplugs in and face on a screen. And I would just say this is such a beautiful time to observe as you're walking about that. I mean, it's not a judgment on, you know, maybe they really need to have their face in the screen, and maybe they really need to, maybe that's how they recharge, and every other time they're out looking around, you know. But I just think that if I had to, I would say that you really need to dedicate some part of your daily life to paying attention. To being curious, to be observant. There's so many authentic experiences that happen, whether it's the hawk that's eating a squirrel right above you, or just, you know, looking at the moon during the daytime and just marveling at there's this big rock that's, you know, doing this dozy-do with our planet through, you know, space. Isn't that, I mean, just to stop and look at the clouds, you know. The trees, you don't need to put names to anything, but just feeling a connection with your fellow earthlings, and that includes the monarchs and the American beech and the squirrel and your fellow humans as well.
Thanks as always.
Oh,
this is a good episode.
Hi,
everyone. Thanks for taking the time to listen to that. We really appreciate you coming back each week and listening to our episodes. I hope that you apply some of the knowledge that Doug shared with us and are a little more observant in your day-to-day life and the things that we have going on around us. As always, keep discovering and come back for another episode of Cast from the Creek.